and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
This is Bob Fitrakis bringing you the other side of the news on WGRN 94.1. This is Dr. Bob Fitrakis bringing you the other side of the news on WGRN 94.1. Today's guest, Melissa McFadden, born in the West Virginia coal country, worked herself up to be a lieutenant in the Columbus Police Department, and has just written a memoir, Walking the Thin Black Line. Okay, so Melissa, we know about the thin blue line. We know about white lines you used to not be able to cross in the North and the South. But what's the thin black line?
So I appreciate you having me on your show. And I want to first say I'm talking and speaking to you as a private citizen. I don't represent the division or anyone other than myself. But I, what it is, as a black officer on the division, working as a law enforcement officer, we have to walk a certain line there. One side is dealing with how law enforcement treats the black community, the mistreatment of the people. And then on the other side is how I have to protect myself from the internal discrimination that's going on inside. So that's a black thin line that we walk on either side. You know, one minute we're doing that, next minute we still got to protect ourselves from the same people that's brutalizing our community. Some of them.
Uh-huh. And as the song used to say, one side's hate and one side's hope. And I know you always erred on the side of being hopeful, right? Yeah. You joined the U.S. Air Force, was it?
Yes. When I turned 18, I went in a month after I turned 18, I joined the United States Air Force because I always wanted to be a police officer since I was 14. And so I figured going.
Well, let's stop right there. You're in West Virginia coal country.
Yes.
I assume that it tends to be fairly white there. What was it that would cause a 14-year-old African-American female to say, I'd like to be a law enforcement officer?
I think because in my life, I've always was for the underdog. I didn't like people getting picked on. I didn't like mistreatment of people just in general. And I always thought policing was a prestigious job. I didn't have a run-ins or anything with the law or mm-hmm. anything like that. But I just always thought it was a prestigious job and a way for me to help people, a way for me to fight for the underdog. And so that's the reason why I wanted to become a police officer. And going into the military, as military police, I figured would give me a good start, which it did. So that's why I went in the Air Force. And that's why I chose that profession, because I felt it was my purpose, it was a calling for me.
And you were part of military police in the Air Force?
Yes, I was a security police for 4 years. I was stationed in Michigan, and I was stationed in Turkey.
Oh, where at in Michigan?
Ward Smith Air Force Base is in Oscoda, Michigan.
Oscoda. Up north, not the Upper Peninsula, but up north in Michigan?
Yeah, right before you get to the Upper Peninsula. I was stationed there for 2.5 years, and then I went to Turkey for a year.
All right, a little warmer in Turkey, I suspect, than yes. Winters in northern Michigan.
Exactly.
So you're saying as you grew up, you really didn't have any run-in with the police?
No, I didn't. I did not. Not at all. I just thought of them as a prestigious job. And matter of fact, it was at the point in my life where I didn't realize that there was other jobs out there that anybody would want to do. Why would you not want to be a police? I thought everybody should be wanting to be a police. I thought something was wrong with my sisters. I'm like, what is wrong? Why would they not want to? So I thought it was such a noble profession. And it was such a calling for me. And that was why I went in the military. And then I moved here to Columbus because my mom moved here.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. My thought was gym teacher. Like you give them a basketball, maybe blow a whistle, and it pays well. And then later when I went to college, I saw the college professors. I'm thinking, a lot of these guys are only here 2 days a week. Maybe I ought to investigate being a college professor. Think deep thoughts in my spare time, which you've been doing in your memoirs. Have to ask you the key question. Have you ever seen the analysis that Andy Griffin, Andy Mayberry was the model for good community policing?
Yes, actually, I watch that all the time. I love Mayberry, Andy Griffin.
And, yeah, the way he treated people, the way he integrated into the community.
Yeah, and I'm a very community-oriented policing. I think it's very valuable. I think we need to build those relationships. I don't think we do a good job here of doing that. There's not a genuine push for community policing. We say we do it in spirit, but we actually don't do it. You see what I'm saying? We say it, but we don't actually put that into place a lot of times, I think. Well, I think it should be in every aspect of our policing, not just our community liaisons as assigned just to do that.
So how would your approach, you're a lieutenant, you're up there. What would your model of community policing look like?
My model would be based on customer service. It would be customer service driven. I would care how the citizens are treated. I would care that it would take 2 hours for someone to take a report from you. I care about that. That when I was a lieutenant on Zone 2B Company out east, the priority was to get taking care of those calls for service. The dispatch calls for service was a priority for me because as a person, a citizen in the community, I put myself in their shoes. So if something happened in my life, it might be my house got burglarized. For an officer, a burglary call, taking a report is not exciting. But to that person that got burglarized, that's the most traumatic thing that's happened to them possibly in their life. Mm-hmm. So we need to recognize that and not look at it like it's a task that we shouldn't be doing or it's an inconvenience. So I think I would put it in every aspect of our policing. Everything we do should be customer service driven. And that is a part of that means holding officers accountable when they're not being customer service driven.
So you've got some strongly held values. Why write a book? Don't you put yourself at risk in some way by writing a book about walking the thin black line in Columbus, Ohio?
Yes, I put myself at risk, but I did it because I've been talking about discrimination my whole career. I've been fighting against it. I went into front of city council. I have talked to many news reporters. I wrote letters to the advisory commission. I've done all these things. I've got a collection, a group of pastors together to go and talk on our behalf. All those things I've done, and none of it seems to be making a lot of change. So I said, I need to do something that's going to get more exposure, something that's going to maybe somebody will read the book and like, I can fix that or I can change that. The more exposure, maybe that will make a difference because what I've done so far has only affected a little change. It hasn't been impactful. We are still in the same situation we were in 2 years ago as Black officers. So I wrote this book in a sense of just to get more exposure to our plight in hopes that they would get somebody that would care enough to do something about what we're going through.
And how would you describe that plight?
We are consistently disciplined at a much higher rate, females and Black officers, than our male white counterparts. And that's been going on since the 80s. There's newspaper articles that I have. When I did my research, Black officers have been complaining about it for many years. Chief Jackson, when he was the chief.
Who is the first African-American chief?
He was.
Was it easier when he was there? They treated Black officers more kindly?
No, it wasn't any easier. It wasn't no easier.
He had a reputation some would suggest maybe treating him a little harsher.
Yeah, that's what I heard, yes. But it wasn't easier. And even he would say in his executive staff newsletters that I have that women and Black officers are getting disciplined at a much higher rate than male whites. Mm-hmm. And he would tell them, you need to be fair in your discipline when you're issuing discipline. And he would say this, but he never did anything and put anything in place to prevent it from happening. So it continues to happen, and we're getting disciplined much harsher for the same exact conduct, or sometimes the male white's conduct's even worse, but we get more discipline. Where they're not, where they're getting days off or suspensions for things, and Black officers do the same thing and they get terminated. When we file complaints of discrimination, because there's a lot of microaggressions that go on throughout my whole career, every day there's something. The book just only focuses on a few things. I couldn't just put everything in there because it would be so long, but there's no hope. If we file a complaint, they try to turn around on us, make us look like we're the racist, or make us look like we've done something wrong. And no one's ever held accountable for discriminating against us or for treating us differently. Our job assignments that we want to get, the desirable assignments, we don't get those because they skip over us or they don't offer them to us. So there's a lot of different things that go on. It's the whole system. And there's many, many more things that we can talk about. The hiring process, how Blacks are washed out of the hiring process. This is so many things that we go through. And I put a lot of things in the book so that somebody else could see it, get more eyes on it. And maybe it can affect some kind of change.
Now, weren't there recent admissions by various people connected with the police department about the hiring of Black officers and the treatment of Black officers?
There was. I mean, the Matrix report they had, I think it came out in 2019. It was a survey that was done, and the Black officers inside said, yeah, we experienced discrimination, and we've seen the discrimination towards the community as well. They did hire EEO compliance officer to take our EEO complaints, but all they did was take her and put her in internal affairs with internal affairs. So it didn't solve anything for us. We still have no confidence in the system. And when we speak up, we're retaliated against.
So in your assessment, it was a bad move to put the EEOC compliance officer in the Internal Affairs Bureau?
Yes, it was a terrible move to put her in with the Internal Affairs investigators. Internal Affairs is responsible for doing the EEO investigations, but they don't do them correctly. They're not properly trained. They always side with the person the person that did the discrimination. They do an investigation in a way that it's not fair. So putting her in there doesn't help us. It doesn't give us faith in the system.
And you're listening to WGRN 94.1. My guest, Melissa McFadden, a lieutenant with the Columbus Police, out with her new memoirs, Walking the Thin Black Line. So let's look at this book. And so you moved to Columbus because your mother has moved here. What made you decide to be a Columbus police officer? And what period was that?
So I moved here in December 93. I got out to Turkey and she had moved here. So it was just made sense to join the police department here. And so that's what I did. Plus I thought, you know, Columbus finest. I'm like, wow, they're nicely dressed and, you know, I'm not from here, so I'm thinking they have a good reputation. It would be something that I'm very proud of to be, you know.
So what was your initial impressions, your thoughts, and your memoir on joining the Columbus Police?
Well, I was excited, and I was so proud that I was Columbus Police. And I was about justice. And then, as you see, the first story I tell is a story where I see an illegal search go on. And my coach, she said, let's get out of here. So we leave. And then she's off and they want me to ride with someone. And I was terrified to ride with him because I had actually said it to the sergeant. Like, I don't want to ride with him. And he's like, why? And I'm like, well, he searched his cars illegally and he's there and everybody else is around me. And they're like looking at me and I'm just like, oh my God, I just said that. So that was my first experience with retaliation because they tried to make me go to a third phase. At that time, if you went to a third phase of training, because you only had two phases of training, if you went to a third one, that means they're trying to get rid of you. They're trying to fire you. So they tried to do that, but I told them, I think it's retaliation because I had not had any bad marks on my record, my first phase or my second phase, until I said and exposed him for doing illegal searches. So after that, I kind of was like, wow, this is really not what I thought it was. It's not as noble. The people in it is not as noble as I thought they would be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so how do you deal with that situation? Because in your memoirs, you were put in situations many times. Do you find you have a tendency to just blurt these things out? And when it comes to right and wrong, I mean, early on that story just, I mean, that seems like you might not be making friends and influencing, you know, older white police officers by stating the obvious.
I know. And as I look back on that story, I have to laugh. I'm like, I cannot believe I said that. I just cannot believe I did that. But at the time, it was the right thing to do. And so for me, I was just so worried that I would be with him and he would do something illegal and I would be in that situation. So at the time, I didn't think that it would cause me any problems because I was new. I didn't realize the code of silence, or you're not supposed to speak like that. You're not supposed to say the truth. I didn't know that at the time. So I was very naive and I was just saying what I felt. And I'm like, I don't want to be involved in nothing illegal. And so saying that now, as I look back, I'm like, wow, I can't believe I said that. But at the time I was naive in thinking that in the military, if somebody does something wrong and you report it, they get in trouble for that. And that's, you know, it's not okay. But here it's just a different story. And I didn't realize that at the time.
Well, how were you able to move up the ranks? I mean, in my understanding, there's only two black female lieutenants in the police. There's no black female ahead of you in the organizational structure. How were you able to survive walking this thin black line?
Well, I had to make a decision. Am I going to be me with my value system and my belief system and stand up for what's right, or I'm going to conform to the corruption and the systemic racism, the systemic mistreatment of people? And so I made that decision that no, I'm going to be who I am, and that's who I am. So with the testing process, you have to take tests. So I studied very hard. And I took four tests to make sergeant, combined your score. I made number one on that list. And then I took the lieutenant's test and I made number seven from study and I got promoted. So it's not that they gave me anything, it's I earned it. And just constantly just being who I am, keeping my own integrity.
Yeah, we have about 10 minutes left. I couldn't help but think of, again, other people that had been there. Officer James Moss, who was there right about 24 years and was with Police Officers for Equal Rights. And he left. But you've managed your, the same period in your career to hang in there. What is your motivation this last part of your career? What do you want to do for the community?
I want the division to start treating the community, all communities, the same. I want all communities to be treated with respect and be valued. Not just some communities. I feel that the poor community and the black community are not valued as much, and they get treated differently. And I don't want that to happen. I want that to stop happening. I want to expose it. I want the division to do right. I want the racist systemic system that I work in, I want it gone.
Well, there was a recent report by Baker Hostetler that couldn't really confirm any police wrongdoing. In part, they said because there was no cooperation by the police. It seems like we're in a city where there's a bit of a standoff between the mayor to some extent and the police officers, particularly through their unions. Is there any hope that that can be overcome?
I think that it can be if the mayor stands steadfast. He's the first mayor that actually, since I've been there, that wasn't hands off with the police department. actually you're trying to do something to make change happen. So I hope he continues on. That right there, that investigation shows you the culture of cover-up we have. We have a culture of cover-up in the division. That's what we've had for years. And that's what happens. And so the citizens should know that now for sure, because there was clearly misconduct on those videos that I saw. And the fact that they can't identify them or they won't identify them, but they always talk about the Black community, how we don't want to snitch on each other. But when it's our turn to stand up and be the example, what we do, we cover it up. And we say, we don't recognize this person or we don't recognize that person. That is unacceptable. And I think it's sad. It's a disservice to our whole community. And the union is a farce. They protect rogue officers. They protect white officers more. They make backroom deals and settlement agreements for white officers where they have Black officers, they get fired. They don't make the settlement and agreements for them. So they don't like the message that the protesters put out there, but we are here to protect and serve. So whether the message you like them or not, you still should be protecting and serving them, not abusing them. So I hope the mayor continues on with what he's doing and trying to make change within the division.
Well, one thing that has always perplexed me is I've always thought the police, at least theoretically and ideally, are the foot soldiers of the Constitution.
Correct.
I mean, they swear an oath, right? You did it when you were in the Air Force. You did it as a police officer, swear an oath to protect the Constitution, to protect and serve the community. And the question, my first class I ever taught, which was a long time ago, winter of 1980, I taught police officers political ideology. And, you know, I was very young, 23-year-old, working on my master's at Wayne State. And the amount of hostility, you know, as I was teaching the Constitution, was overwhelmingly. I did later realize that I did much better with him when I went out and had a drink with him and talked to him very directly. They did understand authority, you know, when I barked back as a professor. But there were these LEAP grants, law enforcement assistant programs. But there seemed, at least back then, it seemed like we were trying. You know, the police should know the Constitution they swear an oath to.
Yes.
I don't see that kind of policy anymore. I mean, why don't the police realize is their main job is to protect the Constitution and protect and serve the community?
I think that they are, they've developed this elitist mentality where they think that they're above the Constitution. I think they think they're above citizens. That's what I think. I think it's a us versus them mentality. Now, when I speak, I speak in general terms, but not all officers are like that. Some officers, there's a lot of officers that do protect people and serve them appropriately.
The vast majority of officers I've ever encountered, I've liked.
Yes.
On the other hand, there's been a few that seem to be overzealous.
But if you look in the book, there's a part in the book where I talk about the punishments that officers get for misconduct. There's no accountability for when you do mistreat people or when you don't follow the Constitution. The accountability is leave forfeiture, which is they're taking so much time out of your bank. So instead of getting a suspension where you lose pay, you don't lose pay. They just take it out of your leave bank that's banked in there. So you don't see any damage to your life or any consequence, you know? So I think that's a part of the problem. And we don't hold those officers that are doing that accountable. And so they get out of control.
So what has been the damage to your life? Has there been a reaction, fallout from you writing this book or the things you've done that's portrayed in the book?
Oh, yes. There's been a lot of fallout of my life. I mean, they've done false investigations on me, accused me of false allegations, had to fight that. So it's a constant battle throughout my life. Of my career in the division to fight for me to stay there and survive because I'm a fighter. That's how my mom raised me. So I couldn't, I knew police is my purpose and I'm built for these fights. So that's why I stay there to make a difference for people that's coming after me. And my presence alone changed how they behave to the community. So I know that that there's a change there when I'm there. So I stay because of that.
Well, we got 2 minutes left. Is there anything you'd like to tell the listeners on WGRN 94.1?
I just appreciate all the community support, because we are an agency that close ranks. They call it close ranks. We don't tell on each other, and they're going to look at me like I'm telling things that I shouldn't tell. So they're going to have a lot of attacks coming at me. So I do appreciate all the calls that I have received from the officers as well as the citizens. And I thank you for your support, and hopefully you'll like the memoir and help me make change for not only for the people inside, but for the community.
Well, where can people get a copy of Walking the Thin Black Line?
They can go to www.walkingthethinblackline.com, or they can get it on Amazon. So you go, that's my website. There's an ebook. You can get the ebook, or you can get the paperback book there, or you can go to Amazon and just type in my name or Walking the Thin Black Line.
All right. Well, thank you for your service, not only in the military, but to the community through your policing methods. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for listening to The Other Side of the News. This is Bob Fitrakis.
And Dan Dugan, WGRN 94.1 LPFM, The Green Renaissance.